Welcome back, everyone, to At HGO Football. We're on the road to Qatar 2022. You know it. We're in our second World Cup. We're done with the flair, the panache of Italia 90. We want endorsements, PR. We want globalization to smack us in the face. We want USA 94. Andrew, we remember this one. We were properly alive. I mean, we were alive for 1990, but this one, you know, we're children. We're football fanatics. It's a big one, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the World Cup's ready for a party, and what better place to go, really? And Diana Ross, Romario, and all.
Well, it's a tale of two different penalties, and Diana Ross is one of them. So, fantastic guest on today, Matt Evans, author of USA 94, the World Cup that changed the game. Matt, it's an obvious place to start, but why did USA 94 change the game?
I think for me, it was sort of like, I think you've already sort of touched on it a bit, sort of like the globalisation of the game, the commercialisation of the game. I think it all sort of started here. You know, the Champions League was still in its infancy, really. We didn't really have the 24-hour football coverage that we have today, you know, where you can literally watch a game every night if you want from various, you know, places around the world. I think USA 94 was the sort of birth of modern football as we know it today.
I mean, the MLS founded a year before, right? I think it was 1993.
Yeah, it didn't start until 96. The whole thing behind USA getting the World Cup was they needed to have its own league. But with the goings-on at board level, with Alan Rothenberg coming in as the head of US soccer, he basically was spinning too many plates, really, if he wanted to get the MLS going in time for the World Cup kicking off. So he spoke to FIFA and sort of said, look, you know, I need to put that on the back burner, really. I need to concentrate on the World Cup. And as soon as you got the tickets were being sold and the TV deals had been signed, FIFA were straight on the phone saying, come on, let's get this league going. So by the time it was all set up and all in place, it kicked off in 96, and they were sort of hoping to build on the success of 94, sort of like attendance-wise, and sort of build on the interest that that the World Cup had brought in 94 in the States.
Mm. Let's make no bones about it. It did bring a lot of interest, and we'd like to think you touched on the attendances, and TV audiences are still ranked amongst the best World Cups ever, if not the best still. We don't want to pry. We're not going to ask you your age, but as a younger man, as a kid at the time, what are your memories as a fan? Was there the interest? Was there a deal of cynicism around the fact that it was going to be in the US?
Oh, there was definite cynicism. I mean, I was 13 that summer. I wasn't a cynical football fan myself at that point. Obviously, I am now.
Yeah, of course. The game does it to you.
But back then there was definite cynicism in the press, especially, you know, there was all rumours of, oh, you know, the USA, they're going to change the rules, they're going to split into four quarters, they're going to have ad breaks and, you know, all things like that. But when I researched the book, the people I spoke to who sort of helped put the World Cup on, you know, like Alan Rothenberg, he said that was never on the table. They were never going to, you know, alter or try and change anything, you know, that they realised what a huge spectacle, you know, the World Cup was, and sort of what an honour it was to host it. So, you know, they had to sort of try and think outside the box, really, in regards to getting the sponsors' names on the screen without having to cut to ad breaks every, you know, couple of minutes like they do in a lot of American sports.
Hmm. I mean, it's a tournament that obviously kicks off in spectacular fashion. USA going into the tournament, sort of, I guess, dipping their toes in soccer at the time. But in terms of the landscape of the sort of world elite and the footballing giants, Matt, how did that look at the time? Your Germanys, your Brazils, your Argentinas, France. Who were the ones that were tipped going into the tournament? There's a lot of talk about Colombia at the time, were widely tipped, weren't they? Particularly being impressive in their qualifying. But what was the landscape like pre-tournament?
Well, the likes of Brazil, who are your sort of perennial favourites now, you know, they'd gone 24 years without winning a World Cup. You know, there was a lot of pressure on their shoulders to deliver. Brazilian Sport was in mourning as Ayrton Senna had died not long before the tournament kicked off. So there's a lot of pressure on Brazil in the US. Obviously, England hadn't qualified. France hadn't qualified. Italy, again, you know, they had the likes of Baggio. You know, the Serie A was huge at the time. It's probably the biggest league in the world at the time. So, you know, Italy were considered, you know, amongst the favourites. As you said, Colombia, they got the dreaded curse of Pele. You know, he said in the build-up to the World Cup, they were one of his tips to win the tournament. Obviously, thrashing Argentina in the qualifiers 5-0 sort of, you know, enhance that. Argentina, you know, they had Maradona. They dragged him back into the fold. And there was obviously, you know, some of the African nations, especially like Nigeria. You know, they were making a World Cup debut. They had some exciting players. So there was obviously a lot of underdog stories, like Sweden and Bulgaria and Romania, who did so well in the tournament that no one would have even, you know, they wouldn't have been on anyone's tip lists.
I think, I mean, looking back, obviously, years later, hindsight is a wonderful thing. There were three sort of key players that I thought pre-tournament that was just fascinating, really, in different ways. You had Maradona, obviously, like you said, being hauled back into the side. I think they qualify in a playoff with Australia, yeah. Was it, I think?
Yeah, that's right,
And he was obviously had his issues off the pitch, having to lose a lot of weight to get back in shape. You had Romario, who was at the time kind of, I guess, on the edge of something special. And obviously the Baggio story as well, carrying an injury in going into that tournament, being heavily relied upon in that Italia, the Sarki's side. Were there any other sort of names that sort of jump out pre-tournament in terms of who to look out for?
You know, the likes of Hristo Stoichkov, Bulgaria, you know, he'd done it in Europe. You know, he was... Like I said before, this was sort of, I'd say, the last World Cup where it wasn't full of household names, you know, whereas, like, so now, like, my kids, they play FIFA, you know, they know players from all around the world that play for the top European sides, you know, and like I said, the Champions League was in its infancy, there was no, obviously, social media, so it was harder to sort of spot these players, you know, that's where, you know, you got your sticker albums, you know, you recognise players from your sticker albums, you know. But yeah, I'd say the likes of Hristo Stoichkov, obviously Georgi Hadji, those two especially were
FIFA classic and a hero in himself.
Yeah, you know, they were, you know, that summer that really put them into his household names. You know, probably the proper football aficionados would have known quite a bit about them, but you know, that really put them his household names really. And like I said about Romario, you know, he was on the periphery with Brazil. You know, they brought him back in, you know, near the end of qualifiers because Brazil was stuttering, you know, and Romario sort of dragged them over the line and got them to the tournament in the first place.
And then a very, 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 very young Ronaldo on the bench.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Carlos Alberto Pereira. He said he was getting people phoning him, said even his mum rang him saying, like, you need to play him. But, you know, he said it wasn't like a Theo Walcott. He wasn't there just to sort of make up the numbers and get experience. He said, you know, if I'd have needed to play him, I would have played him, you know. But when you got Bebeto and Romario in front of you, you know, you're probably not going to get much.
And you mentioned that obviously it was a 24-year wait until that point. And let's face it, I think going into the tournament, this wasn't a Brazil side that was really heavily tipped to sort of end that. I never watched this tournament live at the time. I had sort of the VHS that I used to sort of, I was just addicted to that VHS when I was about 7-8 years of age, looking back on that tournament. But they weren't a particularly glamorous Brazil side. I mean, Dunga, the captain, kind of epitomised their approach, really, apart from the Romario obvious focal point.
Yeah, well, I mean, like teams in the past that had sort of, you know, the likes of the Brazil team in 82 and 86 to an extent, you know, the one thing they didn't have, they had all the flair in the world, but the one thing they didn't have was a goal scorer. You know, if they'd have had the likes of a Romario in that, you know, in those teams, you know, it would have been a different story, I think. But, you know, they still played, you know, they still used some stereotypical Brazilian, you know, football techniques. They got their width from the fullbacks. You know, they they sort of adapted. I think after 24 years wait, they had to adapt. I think they tried to play the Brazilian way all those times, and it blown up in their face. And I think under Carlos Alberto Pereira, I think he finally realised that they did have to adapt, and they had to become, they had to basically not lose the Brazilian style of play, but just adapt more to how the game was going. They realised they couldn't just turn up to these tournaments and try and, you know, string 80 passes together and just blow teams away. You know, the teams were getting wise to them. They had to adapt and become hard to beat.
Mm. I mean, you mentioned sort of cynicism pre-tournament. As we got into full flow, it's actually an exciting tournament, isn't it? I think there's 2.7 goals a game, far outstripping, you know, Italian 90 had drama, but the reality was, from a football perspective, it's quite dire. Whereas actually, 94 USA has underdog stories, which you alluded to earlier. It has a lot of goals, a lot of drama, a lot of cracking goals as well. It's actually in the build-up for this pod, I was watching the top 20 goals of the World Cup. And I was like, oh, 20 seems a bit rich. I just wanted to see the top five and make sure I've brushed up my knowledge before the chat. But actually, I'm sitting there watching all 20 and I'm like, these are some absolute bangers. And so did you feel that, again, you're a young lad, so you may not be potentially noticing the press or the verve or the talk, but did that cynicism slide away a little bit during the tournament?
I think, especially on these shores, I think USA 94, so it was the fact that England weren't in it. I think throughout the tournament, there was a lot of, you know, England aren't there. We're not going to give it as much love as we would other World Cups, you know. And like you said, Italian 90s held so dearly to a lot of like English football fans, you know, Gazza's tears, Ness and Dormer, etc. But as you alluded to, there was hardly any goals. There was plenty of nil-nil draws. Yeah. You know, people talk about, you know, the USA 94 final. You know, it was played in like 100-degree heat. You know, the players absolutely out on their feet. You know, there was no such excuse in Italy 4 years earlier. You know, that final was pretty dire as well. So I think in a lot of people's minds, especially on these shores, I think the fact that England weren't in it, I think it did overshadow it to a lot of people. You know, I've had people message me on Twitter, etc., when I was writing the book saying, oh, I don't remember anything about this World Cup. It was, you know, it wasn't a very good World Cup for me. And then they'd reel off about 10 things they remembered about it. You know, so I think that it definitely in the press, etc., and I think in people's minds looking back, it, because England weren't there, they haven't, a lot of people haven't got like a touching point of, you know, they can go back and look at tournaments and go, oh yeah, tournament, Gazza's tears, Beckham sending off, you know.
Yeah, well, you can't help but think, you know,
there's always a touching point with England, but with that one, there wasn't one. But for me, it's a 13-year-old. It was great not having it, you know, for me, not having any home nations there. I can just focus on just enjoying the football. You know, I adopted the USA as my team. I had the denim shirt with the stars on, you know, and it was just great to see these players that, like I said, you'd only seen before in your sticker albums.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for any listeners that are, out there, any of them that are listening to the pod, if you are new to the series, then shame on you. That's the first thing I've got to say, because we have been putting our guests through the mill with a few sort of questions to do these deep dives on these World Cups. So we've asked Matt a few topical questions just to sort of frame the chat. And the first one that we like to ask is favourite moment of the tournament, Matt. Favourite moment of USA 94. What did you go for?
So favorite moment for me was, you know, as much as I love Baggio, I'd watched him. So I grew up in North Wales, and we used to get a highlights program on a Monday night called Scorio, which used to show Serie A and La Liga highlights. So I'd seen quite a lot of Baggio, and obviously his goal in Italian 90 was one of my favorite goals ever against Czechoslovakia. So for me, his missed penalty in the final, you know, for me, the way it was going, it was going to be, he was going to be, hit Maradona's 86. It was going to be Baggio's 94. You know, he'd overcome injury. He got injured throughout the tournament. He literally carried Italy on his back to the final, gets to the shootout, and he misses. You know, you think it's written here that he's going to score the penalty. Italy going to go on to win the shootout, and he's going to be forever remembered as, you know, USA 94 was Baggio's World Cup. might still be that to some people, but obviously not for the right reasons.
Well, like you say, I mean, he arrives injured, but I think he scores in every knockout round, last 16 quarters, semis, carries them there. And look, what are we now? How many years later, you know, sort of the best 28 years later, we're talking about still the most famous missed penalty of all time. We are, you know, I can't really think of another one that sort of sticks out that in that way, in that manner. On such a global stage, like you said, the hero of the tournament and let's be honest, it's a spectacular miss as well, isn't it? This is the thing. That's what's so iconic about it.
I think I said in my book, it was sort of like, you know, opera style, you know, the tragic opera stories, you know, he'd come alive in the knockouts, as you say, you know, he got subbed for the when Paliuka got sent off. That's against right, yeah. Norway. He was sacrificed. You know, Paul McGrath basically had him in his pocket in the first game, and you thought, well, you know, this is Baggio was probably one of the biggest names in the game at the time, and on the biggest stage, you thought, well, you know, it's going to be a wasted tournament for him. But like I said, as soon as it went into the knockouts, he just came alive. And you know, as much as people say about Baggio's missed pen, you know, without him, Italy wouldn't have been anywhere near the final. Mm. You know, so I just think it's such a crying shame for him to miss the penalty, and that's sort of all he's remembered for. You know, to a lot of people.
Mm. Your favourite goal, a goal that stands out in the tournament. Again, there are some crackers on there.
For me, it's iconic. It's Ray Houghton's goal against Italy for Ireland. Mm. You know, he had a habit of scoring iconic goals for Ireland, Houghton. And I just think it was such a, that game, it was touted as, you know, it's going to be a 50-50 split in the stands, because there's a lot of Irish and Italian immigrants in and around, you know, sort of New York, New Jersey. But by the time kickoff come, I think it was something like 80-20, 70-30 split. You know, and the Irish fans were paying, you know, $200-$300 for tickets. So when the players come out of the tunnel, there was just Irish tricolours everywhere. But I still think, you know, a lot of people didn't give him any hope. But that goal, it was such a strange goal. They seemed to just like float over Paliuka. It's like an age to go in, and you know, the celebration, you know, the forward roll, Terry Phelan's stern face as he gripped him in a bear hug. It was just iconic for me.
I think you've probably got the hardest, best goal pick out of all the World Cups, Tom, don't you think, for this 94?
Yeah, that's what I was just about to say to yourself, Andrew. Like, is there any others that sort of stand out for you on that VHS tape? Oh, do you know what the one that really stands out for me? I can't remember who it's against, but it's the Klinsmann one where he flicks it up sort of on the volley. Mm. Fixes it up himself on the volley and it smashes it home. And I think as an Arsenal fan, obviously the Spurs link that would come, the twice Spurs link with Jürgen Klinsmann, that goal I always just stood out. It's like, oh, he's good, isn't he? I wish we could get him. I've gone to Spurs, like, you know, like, oh, he scored that fantastic goal in the World Cup. And I think when you're a young boy, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, those kind of goals really stand out, especially when there's that sort of, again, the home link that we talked about.
Mm. Yeah, two or three spring to mind. I think Hadji, I think, scored a great goal in this tournament from distance. Yakini, was it the Nigerian who ran in, who was sort of in the net?
Yeah.
That was amazing, that. And then probably Maradona's with the famous celebration, you know, into the camera.
And the Dino Baggio banger, was it against Spain? Where the absolute belts it.
Yeah, it's a good goal.
That's an absolute thunder strike. Yeah, there were some crackers, absolutely. You did allude to it earlier, but one of your favourite kits that stood out. You said you had it. Was the USA Denim Stars.
Yeah, I don't think there's been a better selection of kits either, you know, since then in a World Cup. You know, you'd struggle to find, you know, a bad one, even like Saudi Arabia's with its like really long, baggy sleeves. But yeah, for me, the USA, the denim with the stars, I'm just hoping and praying that 2026, when the World Cup's back I know they're sharing it with Canada and Mexico, that they do some sort of throwback to those kits. I think it'd be a nice touch.
Mm. I mean, it's interesting you say that, because we did a little tweet out a few days ago just in prep for the pod. Matt was coming on, and we tweeted out some for our followers to get involved. And John got back to us on Twitter and said, I don't think there is one bad kit from that World Cup.
Bang on.
That's true. Some fantastic ones.
The German one. The German one was beautiful.
Beautiful. Everyone talked about the German 1990 kit, whereas for me, this far outstrips it.
Yeah.
You know,
I think that's when like a band release an album after like, you know, a seminal classic. I think it's always gonna, you know, it's gotta really go some to be to mention in the same breath. Yeah. But yeah, the German kits were I don't think there was a bad kit.
Yeah, the Bulgaria one's very iconic as well.
Oh yeah.
No,
those Adidas, the stripes coming up, the three stripes, like Sweden as well, Romania, they all had like the same sort of template. Mm. But I just think, I don't know if it's like the colours or, you know.
But rightly so. It should have. It's the 90s, man. Think of the colours. You know, it should be that garish, that ridiculous, that beautiful and that colourful. And it lives up to it. Like every kit was kind of like Siemens kit in 96. Do you know what I mean? Like the colour of every kit was, the whole kit was like that. Yeah. It was brilliant. Like
Campos's goalie kits, you know, they were absolutely,
unreal. The next question we did throw to you was the legacy piece, and I know we've kind of already spoken about it since, but I think what's worth noting here is that, like you said, the MLS League was just signed off, came into action a couple of years later, and in the space of 30 years, you know, if you think how long football's been on our shores and prevalent in the European game, we're now really seeing USA as a big part of football globally, aren't we? And the players that are coming through to play for the very best sides across the world.
Yeah, I think, you know, originally it was known as like a retirement home for footballers to go to. And, you know, don't get me wrong, players still go out there, you know, like Gareth Bale's out there and Chiellini, et cetera, at the moment. But I think you've seen, you know, the USA produce their own players that have gone on to play in big leagues, big European leagues. It's become a place for a lot of young South American talent to sort of take the next step in their career. I just think the game's growing even more, and I think 2026 World Cup will take it on to another level again.
Mm. Yeah, and I think you're right, and I think what you're seeing now is just the depth and number of quality players from the US. You know, throughout the last 20, 30 years, you've had the odd star who'd maybe come over, you know, a Clint Dempsey doing well in the Premier League or whatever it is. But now it's just the depth and the quality. You know, like a, I don't know, like a Brendan Aaronson over now on the moment, just a solid good footballer.
You're getting coaches as well. Now, obviously, you've got Jesse Marsh, who's come over, and even like bikes of the owners, you know, more and more owners are getting involved in.
The ownership thing has probably been here, you know, the last 20 years in a big way in the UK, hasn't it? And obviously, Todd Bowley coming over to Chelsea, ever more so. I think the Premier League are announcing a new pre-season tournament whereby a whole tournament in the US, or that's in the pipes.
Yeah, I've seen that before. I'm sure Jurgen Klopp and Pep Guardiola will be really happy about that.
I'm sure they will. You've also said about the commercialization of the game and the World Cup in itself. USA are said to lead that, though. They still are, you know, the greatest show on earth with the Super Bowl. They still do it very well, don't they? And I don't think we've seen it. We've not seen it really since. And the 26 might be something quite special.
Yeah, I think it's going to take it to a whole new level. I mean, you know, USA 94 was the first tournament where if you could print a logo on it, you know, they'd sell it, you know. And like I said, with the likes of the sponsorships, you know, without going to ad breaks, they struck deals with companies to literally put their logo around the time clock in the corner of the screen. So they were still getting money off these big companies without, you know, having to sacrifice going to ad breaks, etc. You know, it's sort of that sort of business side of things that no one had sort of thought of before. You know, and like I said, with the, you know, the USA, the sort of like, you know, the home of capitalism, if you like, it. You know, they took the globalization, the commercialization of the game to a whole new level. Now, not necessarily a good thing, but you know, it's sort of, I think it's sort of led to where we are today. And like I said, I think in 2026, you'll see it ramped up again. I mean, even the fact that there's a World Cup in Qatar, you know, going back to 94, it was like, why is there a World Cup in the USA? They don't play our football, you know. And I think without going to the USA, you probably wouldn't have had a World Cup in South Africa. You certainly wouldn't have one, you know, in Qatar. I think that sort of opened the eyes to FIFA, that how much money they can actually make out of these tournaments.
Mm. America features in another one of your picks here for best match. Obviously, we can all agree it wasn't going to be the final, but another American pick here. Just for the listeners on Zoom right now. So Matt's got a hot dog in his hand. The Stars and Stripes are flagged in the background.
Home finger.
All of these American loving picks. So you've gone for best match USA Colombia, and obviously that had more layers to it, didn't it? Sadly.
Yeah, well, I think USA is host. They hadn't even picked up a point in Italia 90. They got battered in every game. But coming into 94, you know, to be taken seriously, they said, you know, we had to qualify out of the groups. We couldn't be seen to just turn up and get rolled over in every game. They got a respectable draw against Switzerland in the first game, which most people probably thought was their easiest game. So, you know, going into the Colombia game, again, they've been touted as pre-tournament favourites. USA sort of didn't have much hope, really. But then, like I said, the own goal from Escobar, which obviously had tragic repercussions. And I just think that result for the US, it got a lot of the country on board. You know, they still only crept through into the knockouts, losing the next game. But I think that, again, we're looking back to the start of football going to the next level in that country. I think, you know, if they'd have just got beaten in every game and you know, limped out, then I don't think, you know, I do think it would have, you know, football would have suffered in that country. You know, it wouldn't have grown as well as it has, as quickly as it has.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, just to sort of briefly touch on that, obviously tragic kind of event, really. And in a way, doesn't necessarily mask a tournament, because obviously it happened back in his homeland after the game, and it was nothing to do with, you know, the tournament at all. But just your reflections on that. We were lucky enough to sort of speak to the director of the two Escobars and the famous ESPN documentary, who sort of just, you know, what an amazing filmic piece that was. But your personal thoughts on such a tragedy?
Well, I mean, like, you know, the tournament was still going on when it happened. You know, he could have stayed in the States. He'd been offered a job to do some commentary. You know, he said, no, I want to go home. It's, you know, it's my home city. I've got nothing to sort of, you know, be ashamed of. It's just football, you know. So I said the feel-good factor around the tournament was growing. And then in the space of like a few days, you had Maradona's failed drug test. Mm-hmm. And then you had, you know, Escobar's murder. And, you know, it could have really, really overshadowed the tournament. So, the, you know, Colombian news crews out there just sat in disbelief. You know, he was a huge name in Colombian football. He was on the verge of signing for AC Milan. Mm. You know, he'd probably gone on to be one of, you know...
They weren't too shoddy at the time, were they?
No, exactly. So you've got to be pretty good to play for those. So, yeah, it's just... I think it was more of a... What was happening in Colombia at the time. You know, there was a power vacuum with the likes of the Pablo Escobar. It died like 93. So it was like a power vacuum in Colombia. There was riots and murders on the street, you know, most nights. So I think, you know, it was a reflection of what was happening in Colombia at the time. And I said, even to this day, like the documentary you spoke about, you know, recommend anyone watch it. But I think even to this day, you know, no one knows for sure what, you know, why. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's the main question, you know, why.
Mm. I mean, we had Paul Child actually got in touch with one of his moments, which this is probably the darkest moment of the tournament on the pitch, actually, which was Leonardo's red card that was described as harsh by Kevin Keegan.
the contact from Leonardo on Ramos's chin was similar to when Keegan fell off his bike on Superstars. Yeah, I mean, I remember watching that game, and I was sat there in my USA shirt, and I think it happened so sort of quickly. It did take the replay to sort of realise just, you know, what had actually happened. Yeah. And, you know, talking to, like, I spoke to like Alexi Lalas, who was writing the book, and, you know, he's saying that half time came and they were trying to sort of, you know, discuss tactics and what they needed to do. He said, but we were like seriously worried about, you know, Ramos was needing to get rushed off to hospital. You know, it turned out he'd fractured a, you know, fractured part of his skull. Mm. You know, but if you watch the game afterwards, it didn't even seem to affect Brazil. It didn't even play like they were a man short. You know, the USA, you think, well, they've got, this is the best chance they're ever going to have. But the way Brazil played, they didn't even know they were a man short the way they played.
Just a few more just comments coming in on Twitter before we wrap things up this evening. So Adam Bateman, friend of the pod, gets in touch and says, favourite moment has to be Aldridge going Sparko on the sidelines. Well, that or Houghton's goal against Italy, which we've spoken about earlier. Johns says again, like, just all the list, a long list of players that you just can't forget from that tournament. This one, Tom mentioned this earlier, Beju Patel gets in touch with Klinsmann's flicked up volley against South Korea. That was
South Korea, that's it, yeah.
Yeah, and the Bebeto celebration, obviously. How can we miss that out? And that Campos goalkeeper shirt as well.
Lying by himself.
Yeah, Lloyd mentions the Baggio penalty, obviously, in that huge crowd at the Rose Bowl. Kenneth Anderson against Brazil, an amazing goal.
I think we're getting old, but I just don't believe they do World Cups like this anymore. Like the 94 World Cup and the 98 World Cup for me personally was similar as well. I think you're just in that golden time, aren't you, of our lives, certainly, you know, but basically from between 8 and 18, you know, before other priorities hit and life hit. Yeah, you're just obsessed with football and it's just so many special, amazing moments. Before we close out, Matt, what did it personally leave on you as a legacy? I know, obviously, you've gone on and wrote the book, another plug there, USA 94, the World Cup that changed the game. Go and buy it. Go and get it. But obviously, you've gone on and write the book. I also know you're a big American sports fan in general. And looking back, has it all stemmed from that love affair when you were 13 years old?
I think I've always sort of been intrigued by American culture. You know, growing up, it was, you know, the A-team, Knight Rider, you know, and then like the WWF wrestling, Hulk Hogan, Ultimate Warrior, all that, then into USA 94. I think I've always sort of been intrigued by, like, you know, American culture and, you know, the way they put on a show. But yeah, like I said, looking back at the tournament, I think, you know, the players, I just don't think you'll see such a collection of players, you know, in a tournament, sort of all sort of hitting their peaks at the same time. You know, they've got golden generations like Bulgaria, Romania, Sweden, and even like Nigeria, some, you know, the players that they had. So, yeah, I just think the players, the goals, the stadiums, the kits, you know, I think it's just wrap it all up together. It's, you know, like I said, I don't think we've seen a World Cup like it since. And, hopefully 2026 will be, you know, will be one that someone will be sat talking about in years to come.
Yeah, I think you just given me an idea for a new series. I think just for one series only, we're going to have to do HTO wrestling.
Oh, yeah, I mean, we don't have to sort of like shoehorn it. Try and find, you know, we'll go really on our own, try and find the synergies between WWF in the 90s and the Premier League launch. I think there'll be something there. There'll be something there that people want to read.
I was going to say, what a debate that is. Is it 90s football or 90s wrestling? I mean, wow.
You know, it's a big one. Look, we've plugged the book. Please go and buy it. There may be, stay tuned, an opportunity to win a copy. We'll keep you posted. But Matt, it's been an absolute pleasure. Keep everyone listening on at HTO Football. I hope you've enjoyed your time, Matt. I hope you've enjoyed listening to me again, Andrew. It's been a few times. How many episodes? Many episodes. And keep listening. We're off to France 98 next on the road to Qatar 2022.